Of course, Constantine was much too short, but in his own way, he was handsome, with light brown hair and dark blue eyes and a lively, challenging expression. He could almost have been an American. He was so tan and had such good teeth. But I could tell straight away that he wasn't. He had what no American man I've ever met has had, and that's intuition. From the start, Constantine guessed I wasn't any protege of Mrs. Willard's. I raised an eyebrow here and dropped a dry little laugh there, and pretty soon we were both openly raking Mrs. Willard over the coals. And I thought, this Constantine won't mind if I'm too tall and don't know enough languages and haven't been to Europe. He'll see through all that stuff to what I really am. Constantine drove me to the UN in his old green convertible with cracked, comfortable brown leather seats and the top down. He told me his tan came from playing tennis. And when we were sitting there side by side, flying down the streets in the open sun, he took my hand and squeezed it. And I felt happier than I had been since I was about 9 and running along the hot white beaches with my father the summer before he died. And while Constantine and I sat in one of those hushed plush auditoriums in the UN, next to a stern, muscular Russian girl with no makeup, who was a simultaneous interpreter like Constantine, I thought how strange it had never occurred to me before that I was only purely happy until I was 9 years old. After that, in spite of the Girl Scouts and the piano lessons and the watercolor lessons and the dancing lessons and the sailing camp, all of which my mother scrimped to give me, and college, with crewing in the mist before breakfast and black bottom pies and the little new firecrackers of ideas going off every day, I had never been really happy again. I stared through the Russian girl in her double-breasted gray suit, rattling off idiom after idiom in her own unknowable tongue, which Constantine said was the most difficult part because the Russians don't have the same idioms as our idioms. And I wished with all my heart I could crawl into her and spend the rest of my life barking out one idiom after another. It mightn't make me any happier, but it would be one more little pebble of efficiency among all the other pebbles. Then Constantine and the Russian girl interpreter and the whole bunch of black and white and yellow men arguing down there behind their labeled microphones seemed to move off at a distance. I saw their mouths going up and down without a sound as if they were sitting on the deck of a departing ship, stranding me in the middle of a huge silence. I started adding up all the things I couldn't do. I began with cooking. My grandmother and my mother were such good cooks that I left everything to them. They were always trying to teach me one dish or another, but I would just look on and say, yes, yes, I see, while the instructions slid through my head like water. And then I'd always spoil what I did so nobody would ask me to do it again. I remember Jody, my best and only girlfriend at college in my freshman year, making me scrambled eggs at her house one morning. They tasted unusual, and when I asked her if she'd put in anything extra, she said, cheese and garlic salt. I asked who told her to do that, and she said nobody. She just thought it up. But then she was practical and a sociology major. I didn't know shorthand either. This meant I couldn't get a job after college. My mother kept telling me nobody wanted a plain English major, but an English major who knew shorthand was something else again. Everybody would want her. She would be in demand among all the up-and-coming young men, and she would transcribe letter after thrilling letter. The trouble was, I hated the idea of serving men in any way. I wanted to dictate my own thrilling letters. Besides, those little shorthand symbols in the book my mother showed me seemed just as bad as let T equal time and let S equal the total distance. My list grew longer. I was a terrible dancer. I couldn't carry a tune. I had no sense of balance, and when we had to walk down a narrow board with our hands out and a book on our heads in gym class, I always fell over. I couldn't ride a horse or ski, the two things I wanted to do most, because they cost too much money. I couldn't speak German or read Hebrew or write Chinese. I didn't even know where most of the old, out-of-the-way countries the UN men in front of me represented fitted in on the map. For the first time in my life, sitting there in the soundproof heart of the UN building, between Constantine, who could play tennis as well as simultaneously interpret, and the Russian girl who knew so many idioms, I felt dreadfully inadequate. The trouble was I had been inadequate all along. I simply hadn't thought about it. The one thing I was good at was winning scholarships and prizes, and that era was coming to an end. I felt like a racehorse in a world without racetracks, or a champion college footballer suddenly confronted by Wall Street in a business suit, his days of glory shrunk to a little gold cup on his mantle with a date engraved on it, like the date on a tombstone. I saw my life branching out before me like the green fig tree in the story. From the tip of every branch, like a fat purple fig, a wonderful future beckoned and winked. One fig was a husband and a happy home and children, and another fig was a famous poet, and another fig was a brilliant professor, and another fig was E.G., the amazing editor, and another fig was Europe and Africa and South America, and another fig was Constantine and Socrates and Attila and a pack of other lovers with queer names and offbeat professions, and another fig was an Olympic lady crew champion. And beyond and above these figs were many more figs I couldn't quite make out. I saw myself sitting in the crotch of this fig tree, starving to death, just because I couldn't make up my mind which of the figs I would choose. I wanted each and every one of them, but choosing one meant losing all the rest, and as I sat there, unable to decide, the figs began to wrinkle and go black, and one by one, they plopped to the ground at my feet. Constantine's restaurant smelt of herbs and spices and sour cream. All the time I had been in New York, I had never found such a restaurant. I only found those heavenly hamburger places, where they serve giant hamburgers and soup of the day and four kinds of fancy cake at a very clean counter facing a long, glary mirror. To reach this restaurant, we had to climb down 7 dimly lit steps into a sort of cellar. Travel posters plastered the smoke-dark walls, like so many picture windows, overlooking Swiss lakes and Japanese mountains and African velds, and thick, dusty bottle candles that seemed for centuries to have wept their colored waxes red over blue over green in a fine, three-dimensional lace, cast a circle of light round each table where the faces floated, flushed and flame-like themselves. I don't know what I ate, but I felt immensely better after the first mouthful. It occurred to me that my vision of the fig tree and all the fat figs that withered and fell to earth might well have arisen from the profound void of an empty stomach. Constantine kept refilling our glasses with a sweet Greek wine that tasted of pine bark, and I found myself telling him how I was going to learn German and go to Europe and be a war correspondent like Maggie Higgins. I felt so fine by the time we came to the yogurt and strawberry jam that I decided I would let Constantine seduce me. Ever since Buddy Willard had told me about that waitress, I had been thinking I ought to go out and sleep with somebody myself. Sleeping with Buddy wouldn't count, though, because he would still be one person ahead of me. It would have to be with somebody else. The only boy I ever actually discussed going to bed with was a bitter, hawk-nosed southerner from Yale who came up to college one weekend only to find his date had eloped with a taxi driver the day before. As the girl had lived in my house, and as I was the only one home that particular night, it was my job to cheer him up. At the local coffee shop, hunched in one of the secretive, high-backed booths with hundreds of people's names gouged into the wood, we drank cup after cup of black coffee and talked frankly about sex. This boy, his name was Eric, said he thought it was disgusting the way all the girls at my college stood around on the porches under the porch lights and in the bushes in plain view, necking madly before the 1 o'clock curfew, so everybody passing by could see them. 1 million years of evolution, Eric said bitterly. And what are we? Animals? Then Eric told me how he had slept with his first woman. He went to a southern prep school that specialized in building all-round gentlemen, and by the time you graduated, it was an unwritten rule that you had to have known a woman. Known in the biblical sense, Eric said. So one Saturday, Eric and a few of his classmates took a bus into the nearest city and visited a notorious whorehouse. Eric's whore hadn't even taken off her dress. She was a fat, middle-aged woman with dyed red hair and suspiciously thick lips and rat-colored skin, and she wouldn't turn off the light, so he had had her under a fly-spotted 25-watt bulb, and it was nothing like it was cracked up to be. It was boring as going to the toilet. I said maybe if you loved a woman, it wouldn't seem so boring, but Eric said it would be spoiled by thinking this woman, too, was just an animal like the rest. So if he loved anybody, he would never go to bed with her. He'd go to a whore if he had to, and keep the woman he loved free of all that dirty business. It had crossed my mind at the time that Eric might be a good person to go to bed with, since he had already done it, and, unlike the usual run of boys, didn't seem dirty-minded or silly when he talked about it. But then Eric wrote me a letter saying he thought he might really be able to love me. I was so intelligent and cynical and yet had such a kind face, surprisingly like his older sister's, so I knew it was no use. I was the type he would never go to bed with, and wrote him I was unfortunately about to marry a childhood sweetheart. The more I thought about it, the better I liked the idea of being seduced by a simultaneous interpreter in New York City. Constantine seemed mature and considerate in every way. There were no people I knew he would want to brag to about it, the way college boys bragged about sleeping with girls in the backs of cars to their roommates or their friends on the basketball team. And there would be a pleasant irony in sleeping with a man Mrs. Willard had introduced me to, as if she were, in a roundabout way, to blame for it. When Constantine asked if I would like to come up to his apartment to hear some balalaika records, I smiled to myself. My mother had always told me never, under any circumstances, to go with a man to a man's rooms after an evening out. It could mean only one thing. I am very fond of balalaika music, I said. Constantine's room had a balcony, and the balcony overlooked the river, and we could hear the hooing of the tugs down in the darkness. I felt moved and tender and perfectly certain about what I was going to do. I knew I might have a baby, but that thought hung far and dim in the distance and didn't trouble me at all. There was no 100% sure way not to have a baby, it said in an article my mother cut out of the Reader's Digest and mailed to me at college. This article was written by a married woman lawyer with children, and called In Defense of Chastity. It gave all the reasons a girl shouldn't sleep with anybody but her husband, and then only after they were married. The main point of the article was that a man's world is different from a woman's world, and a man's emotions are different from a woman's emotions, and only marriage can bring the two worlds and the two different sets of emotions together properly. My mother said this was something a girl didn't know about till it was too late, so she had to take the advice of people who were already experts, like a married woman. This woman lawyer said the best men wanted to be pure for their wives, and even if they weren't pure, they wanted to be the ones to teach their wives about sex. So of course they would try to persuade a girl to have sex and say they would marry her later, but as soon as she gave in, they would lose all respect for her and start saying that if she did that with them, she would do that with other men, and they would end up by making her life miserable. The woman finished her article by saying, "Better be safe than sorry, and besides, there was no way of not getting stuck with a baby, and then you'd really be in a pickle." Now, the one thing this article didn't seem to me to consider was how a girl felt. It might be nice to be pure and then to marry a pure man, but what if he suddenly confessed he wasn't pure after we were married, the way Buddy Willard had? I couldn't stand the idea of a woman having to be a single pure life and a man being able to have a double life, one pure and one not. Finally, I decided that if it was so difficult to find a red-blooded, intelligent man who was still pure by the time he was 21, I might as well forget about staying pure myself and marry somebody who wasn't pure either. Then, when he started to make my life miserable, I could make his miserable as well. When I was 19, pureness was the great issue. Instead of the world being divided up into Catholics and Protestants, or Republicans and Democrats, or white men and black men, or even men and women, I saw the world divided into people who had slept with somebody and people who hadn't. And this seemed the only really significant difference between one person and another. I thought a spectacular change would come over me the day I crossed the boundary line. I thought it would be the way I'd feel if I ever visited Europe. I'd come home, and if I looked closely into the mirror, I'd be able to make out a little white alp at the back of my eye. Now I thought that if I looked into the mirror tomorrow, I'd see a doll-sized Constantine sitting in my eye and smiling out at me. Well, for about an hour, we lounged on Constantine's balcony in two separate slingback chairs, with the Victrola playing and the Balalaika records stacked between us. A faint milky light diffused from the streetlights, or the half moon, or the cars, or the stars, I couldn't tell what. But apart from holding my hand, Constantine showed no desire to seduce me whatsoever. I asked if he was engaged or had any special girlfriend, thinking maybe that's what was the matter. But he said no. He made a point of keeping clear of such attachments. At last, I felt a powerful drowsiness drifting through my veins from all the pine bark wine I had drunk. "I think I'll go in and lie down," I said. I strolled casually into the bedroom and stooped over to nudge off my shoes. The clean bed bobbed before me like a safe boat. I stretched full length and shut my eyes. Then I heard Constantine sigh and come in from the balcony. One by one, his shoes clonked onto the floor and he lay down by my side. I looked at him secretly from under a fall of hair. He was lying on his back, his hands under his head, staring at the ceiling. The starched white sleeves of his shirt rolled up to the elbows, glimmered eerily in the half dark, and his tan skin seemed almost black. I thought he must be the most beautiful man I'd ever seen. I thought, if only I had a keen, shapely bone structure to my face, or could discuss politics shrewdly, or was a famous writer, Constantine might find me interesting enough to sleep with. And then I wondered if, as soon as he came to like me, he would sink into ordinariness, and if, as soon as he came to love me, I would find fault after fault the way I did with Buddy Willard and the boys before him. The same thing happened over and over. I would catch sight of some flawless man off in the distance, but as soon as he moved closer, I immediately saw he wouldn't do at all. That's one of the reasons I never wanted to get married. The last thing I wanted was infinite security and to be the place an arrow shoots off from. I wanted change and excitement and to shoot off in all directions myself like the colored arrows from a 4th of July rocket. I woke to the sound of rain. It was pitch dark. After a while, I deciphered the faint outlines of an unfamiliar window. Every so often, a beam of light appeared out of thin air, traversed the wall like a ghostly, exploratory finger, and slid off into nothing again. Then I heard the sound of somebody breathing. At first, I thought it was only myself and that I was lying in the dark in my hotel room after being poisoned. I held my breath, but the breathing kept on. A green eye glowed on the bed beside me. It was divided into quarters like a compass. I reached out slowly and closed my hand on it. I lifted it up. With it came an arm, heavy as a dead man's, but warm with sleep. Constantine's watch said 3 o'clock. He was lying in his shirt and trousers and stocking feet just as I had left him when I dropped asleep. And as my eyes grew used to the darkness, I made out his pale eyelids and his straight nose and his tolerant, shapely mouth. But they seemed insubstantial, as if drawn on fog. For a few minutes, I leaned over, studying him. I had never fallen asleep beside a man before. I tried to imagine what it would be like if Constantine were my husband. It would mean getting up at 7 and cooking him eggs and bacon and toast and coffee and dawdling about in my nightgown and curlers after he'd left for work to wash up the dirty plates and make the bed. And then when he came home after a lively, fascinating day, he'd expect a big dinner, and I'd spend the evening washing up even more dirty plates till I fell into bed, utterly exhausted. This seemed a dreary and wasted life for a girl with 15 years of straight A's, but I knew that's what marriage was like, because cook and clean and wash was just what Buddy Willard's mother did from morning till night. And she was the wife of a university professor and had been a private school teacher herself. Once, when I visited Buddy, I found Mrs. Willard braiding a rug out of strips of wool from Mr. Willard's old suits. She'd spent weeks on that rug, and I had admired the tweedy browns and greens and blues patterning the braid. But after Mrs. Willard was through, instead of hanging the rug on the wall the way I would have done, she put it down in place of her kitchen mat. And in a few days it was soiled and dull and indistinguishable from any mat you could buy for under a dollar in the 5 and 10. And I knew that in spite of all the roses and kisses and restaurant dinners a man showered on a woman before he married her, what he secretly wanted when the wedding service ended was for her to flatten out underneath his feet like Mrs. Willard's kitchen mat. Hadn't my own mother told me that as soon as she and my father left Reno on their honeymoon, my father had been married before, so he needed a divorce. My father said to her, "Whew, that's a relief. Now we can stop pretending and be ourselves." And from that day on, my mother never had a minute's peace. I also remembered Buddy Willard saying, in a sinister, knowing way, that after I had children, I would feel differently. I wouldn't want to write poems anymore. So I began to think maybe it was true. That when you were married and had children, it was like being brainwashed, and afterward you went about numb as a slave in some private totalitarian state. As I stared down at Constantine, the way you stare down at a bright, unattainable pebble at the bottom of a deep well, his eyelids lifted and he looked through me, and his eyes were full of love. I watched dumbly as a shudder of recognition clicked across the blur of tenderness, and the wide pupils went glossy and depthless as patent leather. Constantine sat up, yawning. "What time is it?" 3, I said in a flat voice. "I better go home. I have to be at work first thing in the morning. I'll drive you." As we sat back to back on our separate sides of the bed, fumbling with our shoes in the horrid, cheerful white light of the bed lamp, I sensed Constantine turn round. "Is your hair always like that?" "Like what?" He didn't answer, but reached over and put his hand at the root of my hair and ran his fingers out slowly to the tip ends like a comb. A little electric shock flared through me and I sat quite still. Ever since I was small, I loved feeling somebody comb my hair. It made me go all sleepy and peaceful. "Ah, I know what it is," Constantine said. "You've just washed it." And he bent to lace up his tennis shoes. An hour later, I lay in my hotel listening to the rain. It didn't even sound like rain. It sounded like a tap running. The ache in the middle of my left shin bone came to life, and I abandoned any hope of sleep before 7, when my radio alarm clock would rouse me with its hearty renderings of Sousa. Every time it rained, the old leg break seemed to remember itself, and what it remembered was a dull hurt. Then I thought, Buddy Willard made me break that leg. Then I thought, no, I broke it myself. I broke it on purpose to pay myself back for being such a heel. Mr. Willard drove me up to the Adirondacks. It was the day after Christmas, and a gray sky bellied over us, fat with snow. I felt overstuffed and dull and disappointed, the way I always do the day after Christmas, as if whatever it was, the pine boughs and the candles and the silver and gilt-ribboned presents and the birch log fires and the Christmas turkey and the carols at the piano promised, never came to pass. At Christmas, I almost wished I was a Catholic. First, Mr. Willard drove, and then I drove. I don't know what we talked about, but as the countryside, already deep under old falls of snow, turned us a bleaker shoulder, and as the fir trees crowded down from the gray hills to the road edge, so darkly green they looked black, I grew gloomier and gloomier. I was tempted to tell Mr. Willard to go ahead alone. I would hitchhike home. But one glance at Mr. Willard's face, the silver hair in its boyish crew cut, the clear blue eyes, the pink cheeks, all frosted like a sweet wedding cake with the innocent, trusting expression, and I knew I couldn't do it. I'd have to see the visit through to the end. At midday, the grayness paled a bit, and we parked in an icy turnoff and shared out the tuna fish sandwiches and the oatmeal cookies and the apples and the thermos of black coffee Mrs. Willard had packed for our lunch. Mr. Willard eyed me kindly. Then he cleared his throat and brushed a few last crumbs from his lap. I could tell he was going to say something serious because he was very shy, and I'd heard him clear his throat in that same way before giving an important economics lecture. Nellie and I have always wanted a daughter. For one crazy minute, I thought Mr. Willard was going to announce that Mrs. Willard was pregnant and expecting a baby girl. Then he said, "But I don't see how any daughter could be nicer than you." Mr. Willard must have thought I was crying because I was so glad he wanted to be a father to me. "There, there," he patted my shoulder and cleared his throat once or twice. "I think we understand each other." Then he opened the car door on his side and strolled round to my side, his breath shaping tortuous smoke signals in the gray air. I moved over to the seat he had left, and he started the car, and we drove on. I'm not sure what I expected of Buddy's sanatorium. I think I expected a kind of wooden chalet perched up on top of a small mountain, with rosy-cheeked young men and women, all very attractive but with hectic, glittering eyes, lying covered with thick blankets on outdoor balconies. "TB is like living with a bomb in your lung," Buddy had written to me at college. "You just lie around very quietly hoping it won't go off." I found it hard to imagine Buddy lying quietly. His whole philosophy of life was to be up and doing every second. Even when we went to the beach in the summer, he never lay down to drowse in the sun the way I did. He ran back and forth or played ball or did a little series of rapid push-ups to use the time. Mr. Willard and I waited in the reception room for the end of the afternoon rest cure. The color scheme of the whole sanatorium seemed to be based on liver. Dark, glowering woodwork, burnt brown leather chairs, walls that might once have been white but had succumbed under a spreading malady of mold or damp. A mottled brown linoleum sealed off the floor. On a low coffee table with circular and semicircular stains bitten into the dark veneer lay a few wilted numbers of Time and Life. I flipped to the middle of the nearest magazine. The face of Eisenhower beamed up at me, bald and blank as the face of a fetus in a bottle. After a while, I became aware of a sly leaking noise. For a minute, I thought the walls had begun to discharge the moisture that must saturate them, but then I saw the noise came from a small fountain in one corner of the room. The fountain spurted a few inches into the air from a rough length of pipe, threw up its hands, collapsed, and drowned its ragged dribble in a stone basin of yellowing water. The basin was paved with the white hexagonal tiles one finds in public lavatories. A buzzer sounded. Doors opened and shut in the distance. Then Buddy came in. "Hello, Dad?" Buddy hugged his father and promptly, with a dreadful brightness, came over to me and held out his hand. I shook it. It felt moist and fat. Mr. Willard and I sat together on a leather couch. Buddy perched opposite us on the edge of a slippery armchair. He kept smiling, as if the corners of his mouth were strung up on invisible wire. The last thing I expected was for Buddy to be fat. All the time I thought of him at the sanatorium, I saw shadows carving themselves under his cheekbones and his eyes burning out of almost fleshless sockets. But everything concave about Buddy had suddenly turned convex. A pot belly swelled under the tight white nylon shirt, and his cheeks were round and ruddy as marzipan fruit. Even his laugh sounded plump. Buddy's eyes met mine. "It's the eating," he said. "They stuff us day after day and then just make us lie around. But I'm allowed out on walk hours now, so don't worry, I'll thin down in a couple of weeks." He jumped up, smiling like a glad host. "Would you like to see my room?" I followed Buddy, and Mr. Willard followed me, through a pair of swinging doors set with panes of frosted glass, down a dim, liver-colored corridor, smelling of floor wax and Lysol, and another vaguer odor, like bruised gardenias. Buddy threw open a brown door, and we filed into the narrow room. A lumpy bed, shrouded by a thin white spread pencil-striped with blue, took up most of the space. Next to it stood a bed table with a pitcher and a water glass, and the silver twig of a thermometer poking up from a jar of pink disinfectant. A second table, covered with books and papers and off-kilter clay pots, baked and painted but not glazed, squeezed itself between the bed foot and the closet door. "Well," Mr. Willard breathed, "it looks comfortable enough." Buddy laughed. "What are these?" I picked up a clay ashtray in the shape of a lily pad, with the veinings carefully drawn in yellow on a murky green ground. Buddy didn't smoke. "That's an ashtray," Buddy said. "It's for you." I put the tray down. "I don't smoke." "I know," Buddy said. "I thought you might like it, though." "Well," Mr. Willard rubbed one papery lip against another, "I guess I'll be getting on. I guess I'll be leaving you two young people." "Fine, Dad. You be getting on." I was surprised. I had thought Mr. Willard was going to stay the night before driving me back the next day. "Shall I come, too?" "No, no." Mr. Willard peeled a few bills from his wallet and handed them to Buddy. "See that Esther gets a comfortable seat on the train. She'll stay a day or so, maybe." Buddy escorted his father to the door. I felt Mr. Willard had deserted me. I thought he must have planned it all along, but Buddy said no. His father simply couldn't stand the sight of sickness, and especially his own son's sickness, because he thought all sickness was sickness of the will. Mr. Willard had never been sick a day in his life. I sat down on Buddy's bed. There simply wasn't anywhere else to sit. Buddy rummaged among his papers in a businesslike way. Then he handed me a thin gray magazine. "Turn to page 11. The magazine was printed somewhere in Maine and full of stenciled poems and descriptive paragraphs separated from each other by asterisks. On page 11, I found a poem titled "Florida Dawn." I skipped down through image after image about watermelon lights and turtle green palms and shells fluted like bits of Greek architecture. "Not bad." I thought it was dreadful. "Who wrote it?" Buddy asked with an odd, pigeony smile. My eye dropped to the name on the lower right-hand corner of the page. B. S. Willard. "I don't know." Then I said, "Of course I know, Buddy. You wrote it." Buddy edged over to me. I edged back. I had very little knowledge about TB, but it seemed to me an extremely sinister disease, the way it went on so invisibly. I thought Buddy might well be sitting in his own little murderous aura of TB germs. "Don't worry," Buddy laughed. "I'm not positive." "Positive? You can't catch anything." Buddy stopped for a breath, the way you do in the middle of climbing something very steep. "I want to ask you a question." He had a disquieting new habit of boring into my eyes with his look as if actually bent on piercing my head, the better to analyze what went on inside it. I'd thought of asking it by letter. I had a fleeting vision of a pale blue envelope with a Yale crest on the back flap. But then I decided it would be better if I waited until you came up so I could ask you in person. He paused. "Well, don't you want to know what it is?" "What?" I said in a small, unpromising voice. Buddy sat down beside me. He put his arm around my waist and brushed the hair from my ear. I didn't move. Then I heard him whisper, "How would you like to be Mrs. Buddy Willard?" I had an awful impulse to laugh. I thought how that question would have bowled me over at any time in my 5 or 6 year period of adoring Buddy Willard from a distance. But he saw me hesitate. "Oh, I'm in no shape now, I know," he said quickly. "I'm still on PAS, and I might yet lose a rib or two, but I'll be back at med school by next fall, a year from this spring at the latest." "I think I should tell you something, Buddy." "I know," Buddy said stiffly. "You've met someone." "No, it's not that." "What is it, then?" "I'm never going to get married."
"You're crazy."
Buddy brightened.
"You'll change your mind."
"No, my mind's made up." But Buddy just went on looking cheerful. "Remember," I said, "that time you hitchhiked back to college with me after skit night?"
"I remember."
"Remember how you asked me where I like to live best, the country or the city?"
"And you said..."
"And I said I wanted to live in the country and in the city both." Buddy nodded. "And you," I continued with a sudden force, "laughed and said I had the perfect setup of a true neurotic and that that question came from some questionnaire you'd had in psychology class that week." Buddy's smile dimmed. "Well, you were right. I am neurotic. I could never settle down in either the country or the city."
"You could live between them," Buddy suggested helpfully. "Then you could go to the city sometimes and to the country sometimes."
"Well, what's so neurotic about that?"
Buddy didn't answer.
"Well," I rapped out, thinking, "you can't coddle these sick people. It's the worst thing for them. It'll spoil them to bits."
"Nothing," Buddy said in a pale, still voice.
"Neurotic, ha!" I let out a scornful laugh. "If neurotic is wanting two mutually exclusive things at one and the same time, then I'm neurotic as hell. I'll be flying back and forth between one mutually exclusive thing and another for the rest of my days."
Buddy put his hand on mine. "Let me fly with you."
I stood at the top of the ski slope on Mount Pisgah, looking down. I had no business to be up there. I'd never skied before in my life. Still, I thought I would enjoy the view while I had the chance. At my left, the rope tow deposited skier after skier on the snowy summit, which, packed by much crossing and recrossing and slightly melted in the noon sun, had hardened to the consistency and polish of glass. The cold air punished my lungs and sinuses to a visionary clearness. On every side of me, the red and blue and white-jacketed skiers tore away down the blinding slope like fugitive bits of an American flag. From the foot of the ski run, the imitation log cabin lodge piped its popular songs into the overhang of silence.
"Gazing down on the Jungfrau from our chalet for two."
The lilt and boom threaded by me like an invisible rivulet in a desert of snow. One careless, superb gesture and I would be hurled into motion down the slope toward the small khaki spot in the sidelines among the spectators, which was Buddy Willard. All morning, Buddy had been teaching me how to ski. First, Buddy borrowed skis and ski poles from a friend of his in the village, and ski boots from a doctor's wife whose feet were only one size larger than my own, and a red ski jacket from a student nurse. His persistence in the face of mulishness was astounding. Then I remembered that at medical school, Buddy had won a prize for persuading the most relatives of dead people to have their dead ones cut up whether they needed it or not in the interests of science. I forget what the prize was, but I could just see Buddy in his white coat with his stethoscope sticking out of a side pocket like part of his anatomy, smiling and bowing and talking those numb, dumb relatives into signing the post-mortem papers. Next, Buddy borrowed a car from his own doctor, who'd had TB himself and was very understanding, and we drove off as the buzzer for walk hour rasped along the sunless sanatorium corridors. Buddy had never skied before either, but he said that the elementary principles were quite simple, and as he'd often watched the ski instructors and their pupils, he could teach me all I'd need to know. For the first half hour, I obediently herringboned up a small slope, pushed off with my poles, and coasted straight down. Buddy seemed pleased with my progress. "That's fine, Esther," he observed, as I negotiated my slope for the 20th time. "Now let's try you on the rope toe." I stopped in my tracks, flushed and panting. "But Buddy, I don't know how to zigzag yet. All those people coming down from the top know how to zigzag."
"Oh, you need only go halfway, then you won't gain very much momentum."
And Buddy accompanied me to the rope toe and showed me how to let the rope run through my hands, and then told me to close my fingers round it and go up. It never occurred to me to say no. I wrapped my fingers around the rough, bruising snake of a rope that slithered through them and went up. But the rope dragged me, wobbling and balancing so rapidly I couldn't hope to disassociate myself from it halfway. There was a skier in front of me and a skier behind me, and I'd have been knocked over and stuck full of skis and poles the minute I let go, and I didn't want to make trouble, so I hung quietly on. At the top, though, I had second thoughts. Buddy singled me out, hesitating there in the red jacket. His arms chopped the air like khaki windmills. Then I saw he was signaling me to come down a path that had opened in the middle of the weaving skiers. But as I poised, uneasy with a dry throat, the smooth white path from my feet to his feet grew blurred. A skier crossed it from the left, another crossed it from the right, and Buddy's arms went on waving feebly as antennae from the other side of a field swarming with tiny moving animalcules like germs or bent bright exclamation marks. I looked up from that churning amphitheater to the view beyond it. The great gray eye of the sky looked back at me, its mist-shrouded sun focusing all the white and silent distances that poured from every point of the compass, hill after pale hill, to stall at my feet. The interior voice nagging me not to be a fool, to save my skin and take off my skis and walk down, camouflaged by the scrub pines bordering the slope, fled like a disconsolate mosquito. The thought that I might kill myself formed in my mind coolly as a tree or a flower. I measured the distance to Buddy with my eye. His arms were folded now, and he seemed of a piece with the split rail fence behind him. Numb, brown, and inconsequential. Edging to the rim of the hilltop, I dug the spikes of my poles into the snow and pushed myself into a flight I knew I couldn't stop by skill or any belated access of will. I aimed straight down. A keen wind that had been hiding itself struck me full in the mouth and raked the hair back horizontal on my head. I was descending, but the white sun rose no higher. It hung over the suspended waves of the hills, an insentient pivot without which the world would not exist. A small answering point in my own body flew toward it. I felt my lungs inflate with the inrush of scenery, air, mountains, trees, people. I thought, this is what it is to be happy. I plummeted down past the zigzaggers, the students, the experts, through year after year of doubleness and smiles and compromise into my own past. People and trees receded on either hand like the dark sides of a tunnel as I hurtled on to the still, bright point at the end of it, the pebble at the bottom of the well, the white, sweet baby cradled in its mother's belly. My teeth crunched a gravelly mouthful. Ice water seeped down my throat. Buddy's face hung over me, near and huge, like a distracted planet. Other faces showed themselves up in back of his. Behind them, black dots swarmed on a plane of whiteness. Piece by piece, as at the strokes of a dull godmother's wand, the old world sprang back into position. "You are doing fine," a familiar voice informed my ear. Until that man stepped into your path. People were unfastening my bindings and collecting my ski poles from where they poked skyward askew in their separate snowbanks. The lodge fence propped itself at my back. Buddy bent to pull off my boots and the several pairs of white wool socks that padded them. His plump hand shut on my left foot, then inched up my ankle, closing and probing as if feeling for a concealed weapon. A dispassionate white sun shone at the summit of the sky. I wanted to hone myself on it till I grew saintly and thin and essential as the blade of a knife. "I'm going up," I said. "I'm going to do it again."
"No, you're not."
A queer, satisfied expression came over Buddy's face.
"No, you're not," he repeated with a final smile. "Your leg's broken in two places. You'll be stuck in a cast for months."
I'm so glad they're going to die. Hilda arched her cat limbs in a yawn, buried her head in her arms on the conference table, and went back to sleep. A wisp of bilious green straw perched on her brow like a tropical bird. Bile green. They were promoting it for fall, only Hilda, as usual, was half a year ahead of time. Bile green with black, bile green with white, bile green with Nile green, its kissing cousin. Fashion blurbs, silver and full of nothing, sent up their fishy bubbles in my brain. They surfaced with a hollow pop. I'm so glad they're going to die. I cursed the luck that had timed my arrival in the hotel cafeteria to coincide with Hilda's. After a late night, I felt too dull to think up the excuse that would take me back to my room for the glove, the handkerchief, the umbrella, the notebook I forgot. My penalty was the long, dead walk from the frosted glass doors of the Amazon to the strawberry marble slab of our entry on Madison Avenue. Hilda moved like a mannequin the whole way. "That's a lovely hat. Did you make it?" I half expected Hilda to turn on me and say, "You sound sick." But she only extended and then retracted her swanny neck. "Yes." The night before, I'd seen a play where the heroine was possessed by a Dybbuk. And when the Dybbuk spoke from her mouth, its voice sounded so cavernous and deep, you couldn't tell whether it was a man or a woman. Well, Hilda's voice sounded just like the voice of that Dybbuk. She stared at her reflection in the glossy shop windows as if to make sure, moment by moment, that she continued to exist. The silence between us was so profound, I thought part of it must be my fault. So I said, "Isn't it awful about the Rosenbergs?" The Rosenbergs were to be electrocuted that night. "Yes," Hilda said, and at last I felt I had touched a human string in the cat's cradle of her heart. It was only as the two of us waited for the others in the tomb-like morning gloom of the conference room that Hilda amplified that yes of hers. "It's awful such people should be alive." She yawned then, and her pale orange mouth opened on a large darkness. Fascinated, I stared at the blind cave behind her face until the two lips met and moved and the Dybbuk spoke out of its hiding place. "I'm so glad they're going to die."
"Come on, give us a smile."
I sat on the pink velvet love seat in JC's office holding a paper rose and facing the magazine photographer. I was the last of the 12 to have my picture taken. I had tried concealing myself in the powder room, but it didn't work. Betsy had spied my feet under the doors. I didn't want my picture taken because I was going to cry. I didn't know why I was going to cry, but I knew that if anybody spoke to me or looked at me too closely, the tears would fly out of my eyes and the sobs would fly out of my throat and I'd cry for a week. I could feel the tears brimming and sloshing in me like water in a glass that is unsteady and too full. This was the last round of photographs before the magazine went to press, and we returned to Tulsa or Biloxi or Teaneck or Coos Bay or wherever we'd come from. And we were supposed to be photographed with props to show what we wanted to be. Betsy held an ear of corn to show she wanted to be a farmer's wife, and Hilda held a bald, faceless head of a hatmaker's dummy to show she wanted to design hats, and Doreen held a gold-embroidered sari to show she wanted to be a social worker in India. She didn't really, she told me. She only wanted to get her hands on a sari. When they asked me what I wanted to be, I said I didn't know.
"Oh, sure you know," the photographer said. "She wants," said JC wittily, "to be everything."
I said I wanted to be a poet. Then they scouted about for something for me to hold. JC suggested a book of poems, but the photographer said no, that was too obvious. It should be something that showed what inspired the poems. Finally, JC unclipped the single long-stemmed paper rose from her latest hat. The photographer fiddled with his hot white lights. Show us how happy it makes you to write a poem. I stared through the frieze of rubber plant leaves in JC's window to the blue sky beyond. A few stagey cloud puffs were traveling from right to left. I fixed my eyes on the largest cloud as if, when it passed out of sight, I might have the good luck to pass with it. I felt it was very important to keep the line of my mouth level. Give us a smile. At last, obediently, like the mouth of a ventriloquist's dummy, my own mouth started to quirk up.
Hey, the photographer protested with sudden foreboding. You look like you're going to cry.
I couldn't stop. I buried my face in the pink velvet facade of JC's love seat, and with immense relief, the salt tears and miserable noises that had been prowling around in me all morning burst out into the room. When I lifted my head, the photographer had vanished. JC had vanished as well. I felt limp and betrayed, like the skin shed by a terrible animal. It was a relief to be free of the animal, but it seemed to have taken my spirit with it and everything else it could lay its paws on. I fumbled in my pocketbook for the gilt compact with the mascara and the mascara brush and the eyeshadow and the three lipsticks in the side mirror. The face that peered back at me seemed to be peering from the grating of a prison cell after a prolonged beating. It looked bruised and puffy, and all the wrong colors. It was a face that needed soap and water and Christian tolerance. I started to paint it with small heart. JC breezed back after a decent interval with an armful of manuscripts.
These'll amuse you, she said. Have a good read.
Every morning, a snowy avalanche of manuscripts swelled the dust-gray piles in the office of the fiction editor. Secretly, in studies and attics and schoolrooms all over America, people must be writing. Say someone or other finished a manuscript every minute. In 5 minutes, that would be 5 manuscripts stacked on the fiction editor's desk. Within the hour, there would be 60, crowding each other onto the floor. And in a year... I smiled, seeing a pristine, imaginary manuscript floating in midair with Esther Greenwood typed in the upper right-hand corner. After my month on the magazine, I'd applied for a summer school course with a famous writer where you sent in the manuscript of a story and he read it and said whether you were good enough to be admitted into his class. Of course, it was a very small class, and I had sent in my story a long time ago and hadn't heard from the writer yet. But I was sure I'd find the letter of acceptance waiting on the mail table at home. I decided I'd surprise JC and send in a couple of stories I wrote in this class under a pseudonym. Then one day the fiction editor would come into JC personally and plop the stories down on her desk and say, "Here's something a cut above the usual." And JC would agree and accept them and ask the author to lunch, and it would be me.
Honestly, Doreen said, this one'll be different. Tell me about him, I said stonily. He's from Peru. They're squat, I said. They're ugly as Aztecs. No, 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 sweetie. I've already met him.
We were sitting on my bed in a mess of dirty cotton dresses and laddered nylons and gray underwear, and for 10 minutes Doreen had been trying to persuade me to go to a country club dance with a friend of somebody Lenny knew, which, she insisted, was a very different thing from a friend of Lenny's. But as I was catching the 8 o'clock train home the next morning, I felt I should make some attempt to pack. I also had a dim idea that if I walked the streets of New York by myself all night, something of the city's mystery and magnificence might rub off onto me at last. But I gave it up. It was becoming more and more difficult for me to decide to do anything in those last days. And when I eventually did decide to do something, such as packing a suitcase, I only dragged all my grubby, expensive clothes out of the bureau and the closet and spread them on the chairs and the bed and the floor and then sat and stared at them, utterly perplexed. They seemed to have a separate, mulish identity of their own that refused to be washed and folded and stowed. "It's these clothes," I told Doreen. "I just can't face these clothes when I come back." "That's easy." And in her beautiful one-track way, Doreen started to snatch up slips and stockings and the elaborate strapless bra full of steel springs, a free gift from the Primrose Corset Company, which I'd never had the courage to wear. And finally, one by one, the sad array of queerly cut $40 dresses. "Hey, leave that one out. I'm wearing it." Doreen extricated a black scrap from her bundle and dropped it in my lap. Then, snowballing the rest of the clothes into one soft conglomerate mass, she stuffed them out of sight under the bed. Doreen knocked on the green door with the gold knob. Scuffling and a man's laugh cut short sounded from inside. Then a tall boy in shirt sleeves and a blonde crew cut inched the door open and peered out. "Baby," he roared. Doreen disappeared in his arms. I thought it must be the person Lenny knew. I stood quietly in the doorway in my black sheath and my black stole with the fringe, yellower than ever, but expecting less. "I am an observer," I told myself, as I watched Doreen being handed into the room by the blonde boy to another man who was also tall but dark with slightly longer hair. This man was wearing an immaculate white suit, a pale blue shirt, and a yellow satin tie with a bright stick pin. I couldn't take my eyes off that stick pin. A great white light seemed to shoot out of it, illuminating the room. Then the light withdrew into itself, leaving a dewdrop on the field of gold. I put one foot in front of the other. "That's a diamond," somebody said, and a lot of people burst out laughing. My nail tapped a glassy facet. "Her first diamond. Give it to her, Marco." Marco bowed and deposited the stick pin in my palm. It dazzled and danced with light like a heavenly ice cube. I slipped it quickly into my imitation jet bead evening bag and looked around. The faces were empty as plates, and nobody seemed to be breathing. Fortunately, a dry, hard hand encircled my upper arm. "I am escorting the lady for the rest of the evening. Perhaps," the spark in Marco's eyes extinguished and they went black, "I shall perform some small service," somebody laughed, "worthy of a diamond." The hand round my arm tightened. Ouch. Marco removed his hand. I looked down at my arm. A thumbprint purpled into view. Marco watched me. Then he pointed to the underside of my arm. "Look there." I looked and saw four faint matching prints. "You see, I am quite serious." Marco's small, flickering smile reminded me of a snake I'd teased in the Bronx Zoo. When I tapped my finger on the stout cage glass, the snake had opened its clockwork jaws and seemed to smile. Then it struck and struck and struck at the invisible pane till I moved off. I had never met a woman hater before. I could tell Marco was a woman hater because in spite of all the models and TV starlets in the room that night, he paid attention to nobody but me. Not out of kindness or even curiosity, but because I'd happened to be dealt to him like a playing card in a pack of identical cards. A man in the country club band stepped up to the mic and started shaking those seed pod rattles that mean South American music. Marco reached for my hand, but I hung on to my fourth daiquiri and stayed put. I'd never had a daiquiri before. The reason I had a daiquiri was because Marco ordered it for me, and I felt so grateful he hadn't asked what sort of drink I wanted that I didn't say a word. I just drank one daiquiri after another. Marco looked at me. "No," I said. "What do you mean, no? I can't dance to that kind of music. Don't be stupid. I want to sit here and finish my drink." Marco bent toward me with a tight smile, and in one scoop, my drink took wing and landed in a potted palm. Then Marco gripped my hand in such a way I had to choose between following him onto the dance floor or having my arm torn off. "It's a tango." Marco maneuvered me out among the dancers. I love tangos. I can't dance. You don't have to dance. I'll do the dancing. Marco hooked an arm around my waist and jerked me up against his dazzling white suit. Then he said, "Pretend you are drowning." I shut my eyes and the music broke over me like a rainstorm. Marco's leg slid forward against mine and my leg slid back, and I seemed to be riveted to him, limb for limb, moving as he moved without any will or knowledge of my own. And after a while I thought, it doesn't take two to dance, it only takes one. And I let myself blow and bend like a tree in the wind. "What did I tell you?" Marco's breath scorched my ear. "You're a perfectly respectable dancer." I began to see why women haters could make such fools of women. Women haters were like gods, invulnerable and chock full of power. They descended and then they disappeared. You could never catch one. After the South American music, there was an interval. Marco led me through the French doors into the garden. Lights and voices spilled from the ballroom window, but a few yards beyond, the darkness drew up its barricade and sealed them off. In the infinitesimal glow of the stars, the trees and flowers were strewing their cool odors. There was no moon. The box hedges shut behind us. A deserted golf course stretched away toward a few hilly clumps of trees, and I felt the whole desolate familiarity of the scene, the country club and the dance and the lawn with its single cricket. I didn't know where I was, but it was somewhere in the wealthy suburbs of New York. Marco produced a slim cigar and a silver lighter in the shape of a bullet. He set the cigar between his lips and bent over the small flare. His face, with its exaggerated shadows and planes of light, looked alien and pained, like a refugee's. I watched him. "Who are you in love with?" I said then. For a minute, Marco didn't say anything. He simply opened his mouth and breathed out a blue vaporous ring. "Perfect," he laughed. The ring widened and blurred, ghost pale in the dark air. "Ben," he said, "I am in love with my cousin." I felt no surprise. "Why don't you marry her?" "Impossible." "Why?" Marco shrugged. "She's my first cousin. She's going to be a nun." "Is she beautiful?" "There's no one to touch her." "Does she know you love her?" "Of course." I paused. The obstacle seemed unreal to me. "If you love her," I said, "you'll love somebody else someday." Marco dashed his cigar underfoot. The ground soared and struck me with a soft shock. Mud squirmed through my fingers. Marco waited until I half rose. Then he put both hands on my shoulders and flung me back. "My dress." "Your dress." The mud oozed and adjusted itself to my shoulder blades. "Your dress." Marco's face lowered cloudily over mine. A few drops of spit struck my lips. "Your dress is black, and the dirt is black as well." Then he threw himself face down as if he would grind his body through me and into the mud. "It's happening," I thought. "It's happening. If I just lie here and do nothing, it will happen." Marco set his teeth to the strap at my shoulder and tore my sheath to the waist. I saw the glimmer of bare skin, like a pale veil separating two bloody-minded adversaries. "Slut." The word hissed in my ear. "Slut." The dust cleared, and I had a full view of the battle. I began to writhe and bite. Marco weighed me to the earth. "Slut." I gouged at his leg with the sharp heel of my shoe. He turned, fumbling for the hurt. Then I fisted my fingers together and smashed them at his nose. It was like hitting the steel plate of a battleship. Marco sat up. I began to cry.